I'm here today to talk about mental health and faith and self-care. So if you're not here to hear about that, then you can leave. You can leave at any time. But I'm going to talk about that until you leave. Let me start by telling you briefly about myself. I'm the executive director of a non-profit based here in Vancouver, increasingly working in other countries around the world as well. And we create resources to equip the church with tools to help them hold space for people in the midst of a mental health crisis. It's our belief that the church should be the safest place, and sadly, often it isn't. So we're an organization that exists to help with that. Great. So let me begin. One of the challenges of speaking about this very large subject for 45 minutes is not long enough. So I'm going to have to make a few assumptions as we go. That's not because I haven't got a well thought through idea of why we hold to these beliefs, these values, but it's because we don't have time. So you forgive me. And if there's time at the end, which I hope there might be for one or two questions, we'll do that. But we're going to finish at four. Great. So let's start with mental health. What do we mean by mental health? Well, the World Health Organization defines mental health this way: a state of well-being in which every individual realizes his or her own potential, can cope with the normal stresses of life, can work productively and fruitfully, and is able to make a contribution to his or her community. At its most basic and essential level, mental health is a positive sense of emotional, social, and spiritual well-being and being able to cope with the normal stresses of life. There are a few ways we can characterize mental health. These will give you a few clues, a few insights into how your mental health is doing. Self-awareness. Are we able to recognize and develop our strengths so that we reach our full potential? Are we aware of our weaknesses? Are we aware of our trigger points? Are we aware of the things where we're not doing so well? Resilience. Are we able to bounce back from hard times? All of us in our lives have bad times. If you don't, then you're living in denial. We all have bad times and bad things happen. So how quickly are we able to bounce back? That's an indicator. Balance or harmony, are we able to juggle the many aspects of our lives? Flexibility, when problems arise, can we change our expectations of life and others and ourselves to solve the problem and feel better? And finally, the ability to enjoy life. Can we live in the moment and enjoy this moment for what it is? Can we appreciate the now? These are all indicators of how our mental health is doing. And as we'll soon find out, our mental health moves and fluctuates and changes depending on what life throws at us. So what does the Bible have to say about mental health? Well, perhaps the first thing to be said about mental health in the Bible is that nowhere in Scripture does it use the term mental health. But just because the term isn't used doesn't mean it isn't present. In a similar way, the Bible makes no mention of the Trinity. Trinity was a doctrine created hundreds of years after the Bible was written. But once you know the doctrine of the Trinity, which is necessarily implied through the Scriptures, once you know it, you see the Trinity everywhere. You open up your Bible to any book of the Bible and you start to see the work of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit throughout the whole arc of Scripture. Similarly, when you have the glasses, the lenses, the perspective to see mental health, you open the pages of Scripture and you see it everywhere. You see people in the depths. I mean, read the Psalms. 40% of the Psalms are lament. 40% of the Psalms are people saying, everything is terrible. And one of them really ends in that place. Darkness is my only friend. I think that's Psalm 80. Darkness is my only friend. That's how the psalm ends. But most of them have a twist at some point in the psalm when the person in the midst of darkness catches a glimpse of God with them in the midst of the darkness. And they have this new revelation of who God is. It isn't that the pain goes away, but they realize they're not alone in the pain. And that is a definition of joy. Joy is what the world needs. Happiness is fleeting. Happiness is a Buddhist ideal that we pursue. Happiness is futile. It's like pursuing the wind. Happiness comes and goes, but joy, to know God in the midst even of pain, that's what we can foster in Christian community. So, yes, the Bible has lots to say about mental health, but we need the lenses to see it. You know, the closest biblical term we have for mental health in the Bible is the biblical concept of shalom. Shalom is a profound word which has a rich and deep and thick and dense meaning. It is relational well-being at every fiber of our being, at every level of society. It is supreme relational depth, quality and meaning at every level of every atom of creation. It is the lordship of Jesus over all things and all people, where all things and all people are aware and in sync with this truth. This is a picture of well-being, a picture of mental health, of flourishing, defined by the quality of our relationships. I can think of four relationships that help us foster wellness or shalom or mental health flourishing. But the four relationships I can think of are God and self and others and creation. Historically, Western theologians would generally focus on God, self, and others. But I would suggest that's a very Western idea to eject creation, as if this is somehow meaningless. One good reason to include creation in our relational depth and the way we relate to the world, how we know wellness, is because of technology, which is part of the created order. And we need to seriously consider how we relate to technology in this day and age. So what I'm suggesting is that wellness is ultimately a relational issue. Ultimately, we are relational beings made in the image of a relational God. And it is the quality of our relationships to God, self, others, and creation in no particular order that we need to foster in order to enjoy wellness. In the scriptures, there is this concept, God, Jesus continually picks up that to love God and love others and love self, as an example, is imperative. And each one connects to the other. You can't say, well, I've got a great relationship with God, but I don't really like anyone else. God would say, no, you can't do that. You can't separate one relationship from the other. How we relate to others and self and God and creation impacts all of the other relationships, for better and for worse. I did warn you I'd go quickly, okay? So I'm making lots of assumptions. So as people, we are biological, we are psychological, we are social, and we are spiritual. We call this the bio-psycho-social-spiritual model. Historically, medical science has acknowledged the bio-psycho-social model, though in recent years there has been more accommodating of the spiritual nature of persons. Even science is understanding there's something else about us that is more than just biological and psychological and social. And by social, we mean our interactions with others, that we are relational beings. So again, in this model, we see four aspects of our personhood which all interact and relate to each other. Our biology, our psychology, our social nature, and our spirituality all intersect. You can't tease them out and go, I'm going to have a spiritual time now. That's what our culture in the West has done. And so we go, well, I'm being spiritual on a Sunday morning. This is not how other areas of the world see it. Other cultures don't see spirituality in this segmented, siloed way, nor do they see psychology or biology or our social connection. They see them all together, and I would suggest that's a better way of seeing it, because what happens to us biologically can impact us psychologically and socially and spiritually. What happens to us spiritually and vice versa. You get the picture. So let's think about mental health. I really hope this is a useful table for you. I'm going to very quickly try and explain it to you. This is the work of an American psychologist, sociologist, and mental health promotion researcher called Dr. Corey Keyes, and he developed a model of mental wellness called the mental health continuum. In his model, mental health is understood as encompassing the correlated but distinct factors of well-being, mental health, and mental illness. Mental health and mental illness are kind of two separate conversations. I don't know about you, but implicitly growing up, I had this idea that we had one continuum. At one end was mental illness, and at one end was mental health. And every human being lives somewhere along that continuum. Dr. Corey Keyes says this cannot be true because in his research, he found two groups of people that don't fit on that continuum. he found 10% of people that he surveyed, which is a large group, obviously, were people who languished in their mental health, but they didn't have a diagnosed mental illness. Poor mental health, but no mental illness. And then he found 15% of people that had a diagnosed mental illness, but had good mental health. So when we look at this diagram, the people living with a diagnosed mental illness but good mental health are in the top left quadrant, and the people living without a mental illness and languishing in their mental health live in the bottom right quadrant. The other two kind of make sense. You know, someone with a diagnosed mental illness who's languishing in their mental health and someone who's flourishing in their mental health who doesn't have a diagnosed mental illness. But what this table shows us is that every human being that lives is on this table, and everyone on this table moves around it. And if you're anything like me, you can move around it in a day, let alone seasons. But some people, for whatever reason, for biological, for psychological, for social, for spiritual, and normally a combination of all of them, find it harder to move into a place of flourishing. Sanctuary would say, this table offers us hope, because it says whether you have a diagnosed mental illness or not, all of us can move towards flourishing if we give ourselves the right surroundings, the right environment in which to flourish. So let's quickly play this out with two caricatures. Imagine a person who is diagnosed with schizophrenia. They receive the diagnosis, they come home, and they talk to their family. They say, I've been diagnosed with schizophrenia. The family had suspected something was wrong. And what the family do is they get around this person and they say, well, we love you, this doesn't change anything, what can we do to support you? What do you need? They then meet with the pastor of their church. I've been diagnosed with schizophrenia. The pastor says, well, I'd noticed some things were going on. How can we support you? What can we do to care for you? What can we say that will help you? What shouldn't we say? How do you need us to care for you spiritually? They then go to the doctor. The doctor who was trained recently says, great, okay, I have a lot of experience dealing with this. So what we're going to do is we're going to put you on a medical trial and we're going to work with you. And actually, let's get your family and your pastor in and let's talk to them about how we care for you, how we support you. And we're going to get you on some medication that's going to help you. Presuming that's what the person wants, because maybe the voices they're hearing are disturbing them. Then they say, right, we need some therapies. They get a therapist. So the point is, this person is building a circle of care around their lives that is allowing them to flourish. The issue isn't whether they have an illness, a diagnosed illness or not. The issue is, can this person move to a place of flourishing? Can they surround themselves with an environment that helps them to flourish as best as they are able as an individual made in God's image? So there's one caricature. Now think of another caricature. I like to think of this person as a white man in his 60s, who's attended church his whole life. His family are immaculately dressed and presented every week at church. His children behave impeccably, like my own. This person has a great job, drives an expensive car, tithes, is an elder, trusted member of the church. But what you find out one day is that he can't sleep at night, so he's been taking sleeping pills. And because he's created this perfect life that he feels he needs to present to people, he's unable to talk about what's really going on, which is that he's carried anxiety for years. And he can't sleep, and he can't talk about it. And one day it causes him to have what many people would call a breakdown. And everyone says, well, I didn't know. We didn't know there was a problem. This is way more common than we want to admit. And there are way more people on the cusp or at any point could fall into a place of languishing because they're not addressing the inner issues that are going on. So shalom as a concept, ultimate peace at every level of our being, wellness, is possible for people irrespective of illness. Which may sound controversial, but when we think about it, you know, is it possible for someone to have a biological illness? I mean, just pick one. Is it possible for someone to have terminal cancer and know shalom, to know the peace of God that says, I am God's and he is mine? Well, yes, it is possible. Is it possible for someone to be an Olympic athlete who's just won a gold medal who isn't at peace with God? Well, yes, it's possible. And so we begin to unpack the prejudices our Western culture has for basically saying that we view wellness as people who are healthy and wealthy. If you're healthy and wealthy, you know wellness. Well, the Bible says something very different. Wellness is about the depth and quality of our relationship to God, not how much money or physical health we have. or psychological health for that matter. So we are all on the continuum. We are all on the continuum. But mental illness is undoubtedly an experience that makes flourishing harder, makes it more difficult. You know, often people who have been through a mental illness are really boundaried. They're really good at knowing how to live well lives that are well, to live life well. Because they've had to think through, how do I build a life that's going to let me flourish? They've had to really think through, how do I care for myself? What do I do and what do I not do? What are the rhythms of my life? Whereas others of us just kind of muddle our way through it and never really stop to think, how much sleep do I need? What do I need to eat? What do I need to talk to my doctor about? Who am I surrounding myself with? Who am I not surrounding myself with? So we have a lot to learn from people that have experienced mental illness, as our culture labels it. It's interesting, Sanctuary, we launched a podcast, which you're welcome, obviously welcome to listen to. It's available on all good podcast places, whatever they're called. But our last podcast was by a poet and priest called Malcolm Guite. And in his discussion of his own experiences with depression, said, you know, in our culture, we take people who are depressed and we say there's something wrong with them. But he said, I wonder if there's actually something right with them when we look at the world. In some senses, being depressed when we look at the world kind of makes sense. He says these people are more like our antenna, our people who warn us about what's going on in the world. They're our most sensitive people. We should listen to them instead of just medicating their problems away. We should be listening to them. I thought it was a very astute point. So the other thing this tells us is that mental health is not static. All of life is a journey back and forth on this continuum. We move around it as we respond to the stresses in life. Sometimes we move up and down this continuum in the course of a day, and we certainly move up and down it in the course of our lifetime. There is no us and them when we talk about mental health. Very often a common response I get when I say I lead a mental health charity is people say something like, oh, I have an uncle who lives with depression, or oh, I have a friend. And of course, yes, that may be true, but the issue is not that they have a mental health challenge. The point is, all of us are one event or one situation away from having a mental health challenge. And many people have them and just don't know it. I have a good friend, when I was in England recently speaking at a pastor's conference, a good friend of mine asked to see me with his wife in a break, and she sat down. She's been a pastor's wife for like 35 years. And she just sat down and opened up and said, I'm just finished. I'm so tired. I'm so tired of church. I'm so, you know. And they sort of said, what do we do? And I said, I think you need to talk to your doctor, first and foremost. Because it sounds like maybe you need some help. I actually messaged him this morning because his soccer team lost, so I was giving him a hard time, which is what you do in Britain when you care for someone. And I said, how is your wife doing? And he said, she went to the doctor and she's been diagnosed with depression. And it's been a real shock to her. She never thought that that would be the case. I said, well, no one ever does. No one ever plans to have a mental illness or a mental health problem. But now, hopefully, she's getting the care she needs to help move to a place of flourishing, which may include medication. It may include cognitive behavioral therapy. It may include all sorts of things. And it will almost certainly include prayer as well, because she's a person of faith, and that's what she wants. So all of us are on this, on the mental health continuum, and we all move around it. I think this is a really helpful way of framing this with friends and family and colleagues, to really ask the question, okay, so where are you today? Where were you yesterday? What trajectory are you on at the moment? And what can we do as a community to ensure that we can build an environment where you can move towards flourishing? So, as I've said in all of this, maybe it's worth saying that in a languishing state, whether we have mental illness or not, some of the hallmarks of that are social isolation, disconnection, inner dysfunction, and all of us need information, education, and resources to help us. But more than that, we need relationships. We need relational depth to help us as relational beings made in the image of a relational God. Now, I would love to go into the history of why we've got to this place in the world where hearing that we are relational beings made in the image of a relational God is kind of like good news to us. this has always been true. But I would suggest our Western culture has gone down a track that has led us down an alley that is kind of hard for us to get out of. And I would attribute that to post-Enlightenment thought and that all kinds of historical things like Lockean philosophy, René Descartes, I think therefore I am, but we don't have time for that. But if you're interested in that, then we can talk about that another time. Needless to say, the Bible can keep us true if we turn to it. So this is an interesting table. This is the stress-vulnerability interaction. One of the big questions we get is people say, well, why does one person develop a mental illness while another person, under the same life circumstances, doesn't? Why one person, not the other? That classic advice, or good advice, questionable advice, I would say, from people who say, oh, you've got depression. I know what you need to do. You need to eat more flaxseed. That's the answer to all your problems. There are always those people that want to give you advice on what worked for them or their friend, or, you know, oh, well, you need to pray this special prayer. And you pray it 7 times a day for 7 weeks and everything gets better. I would be wary of those kinds of claims, because the point is we are all individuals and our experiences are different. Even siblings will have different genetic makeup, different biological makeups, different ways of interacting with the world, different experiences with the world. And of course, as if that needs qualification, when we think about it, you know, you could have two brothers that have the same upbringing, they could be twins, and if one goes to war and one doesn't, the one who goes to war is probably possibly more likely to experience post-traumatic stress disorder. So it's kind of an obvious point to make, but all of our life experiences are different. But this table helps us to just put words to that. So on the x-axis, this personal vulnerability axis refers to our basic susceptibility to mental health problems and mental illness, which is determined by our genetic makeup and our early life experiences. In the last 20 years, we found out that the first 18 months of a child's life are absolutely imperative to them knowing who they are. And that's because we're relational beings. So in the first 18 months of a child's life, a child doesn't know it's a person. A child is just an extension of its primary carer. Now, if you remove relationships from someone in the first 18 months, they spend the first 18 months of their life not knowing what they are. You need that relational depth to make that connection. And science has proven this. This isn't Christian work. This is science. And it absolutely lines up with the biblical notion that we are relational beings made in the image of a relational God, made for relationship. Ultimately to God, but also through our parents who God gives us. There's so much more I could say. But personal vulnerability is different for all of us. And as this table demonstrates, all of us have a different level of personal vulnerability depending on what happens to us. And our early years shape us and can lead us to development of vulnerabilities. But our entire lifespan is one where change can happen. And we may be more or less vulnerable at certain times of our lives for a range of various holistic reasons. I have quite a few friends that have developed mental illnesses after having children. That's just anecdotal that I'm saying to you. I have quite a few friends. Something has changed in their life and something has changed. And you know, taking on the responsibility for a person is a big responsibility. That's a big change. So these can change. It can also change for the better. And I'd hate for someone sitting here who maybe knows they didn't have a great connection in the first 18 months of life or in their childhood development. Things can change. Again, science shows that we can reprogram the brain. Neuroplasticity, the idea that neuropathways in our brain can be altered and changed with a loving, caring environment, is proven. And again, I think of Paul's renewing of the mind. It kind of stacks, it lines up with science. So the x-axis refers to our vulnerability, which is different for all of us, depending on a range of reasons, and the y-axis refers to stress, the challenges we face in life. And the biological vulnerability and stress are influenced by several other factors, potentially alcohol and drug use, medication use, coping skills, social support, meaningful activities, all of these things influence. So someone may have low vulnerability, they may have 20% vulnerability, which means they can handle a lot more stress. This person may be able to be a firefighter and walk into a burning building and rescue people without breaking sweat. Someone with a lot of vulnerability, maybe 99% of vulnerability, it will take every ounce of bravery they have to turn up to a church meeting and sit in a pew. And never underestimate the bravery it takes some people in the midst of a mental health crisis to just turn up. If you know people who are in the midst of a mental health crisis who do turn up to church, every now and again, just encourage them. I see your bravery. I think it's amazing. I'm inspired by you. So if your personal vulnerability is very high, it can take very little stress to tip you into psychological ill health. So how is it that some people can be tipped into psychological ill health doing something menial that you just do every day? Well, their vulnerability is different to yours. Their experience of life is different. But as I said, our capacities can change over time for better and for worse. And we can learn to understand our capacity and to be more boundaried. As I said earlier, a lot of people with diagnosed mental illnesses are really boundaried. They know what they can and can't do. In that sense, they're very healthy. We have a lot to learn. So certainly these kind of difficult negative experiences can cause us to live a more boundaried full life when we get through the darkness. Finally, with the continuum earlier, just a little anecdote before I get onto self-care. We had someone join our organization who, when we talked to them about the mental health continuum, we love the mental health continuum. We go, oh, this is our mental health continuum. Well, it's someone else's, but we use it and we love it. It's a great way of framing a person's experience. She said, can I just do the obvious and draw a circle around it and write God in the circle? Just to really underline and emphasize that whatever your experience, wherever you are, you're not outside the bounds of God. Like, God is present and available to you. This is nowhere on this continuum is irrelevant in the sight of God. God is present to you in the midst of it all, and he has to be, right? If he isn't, get a different God. God has to be present to everyone. That is the good news. And the thing I loved about it when she drew a circle around it was, this is just me, but I suddenly went, the continuum has become a Celtic cross. And the Celtic cross is an ancient symbol of the cross of Christ speaking to the center of all that is known, to the whole of creation. The cross of Christ speaks to us. So once again, this image, I'm sure Dr. Corey Keyes didn't intend it, but for me, it is a message that speaks of Christ available, present to all of us, whatever our place on the continuum. Wherever we may be today or tomorrow or next year, Christ is present. And there is something profound and hope-filled in knowing that. So let's talk about self-care. Stay with me. I'd love to give you a break because I've given you like probably 3 hours of material in 25 minutes. But there we go. We're going to talk about self-care. Probably doing 3 hours of material in 25 minutes is not a very good example of self-care. But there we go. So what is self-care? What do we mean by self-care? Well, self-care is any activity that we do deliberately in order to take care of our mental, emotional, and physical health. In other words, self-care is an intention. When we practice self-care, we are engaging in an activity with the specific intention of caring for ourselves. This activity might be fairly normal and routine, such as going to the gym, or it might be unique, such as attending a weekend retreat. Either way, the focus of the experience is on actively loving and caring for ourselves. So here's a question. It can be a rhetorical question. I don't mind you shouting out answers if you want to. But why do we find self-care so hard, assuming that we do? In my experience of being a Christian, I think churches find self-care pretty hard. Like, I've never heard anyone talk about it or validate it. Why do we find it so hard? Why do many of us not know how to care for ourselves? Well, there are a few reasons I can think of. Let me share those with you. Generally, churches, without intending to, I think, generally don't reward or praise self-care. Self-care isn't really modeled frequently in churches. Generally, we expect leaders and ministers to press in and get burnt out. And the way we structure roles, I'm a minister who got very close to that, so I speak from my own experience. And it wasn't because people didn't love me or because, people didn't intend well for me. It was just because the system seemed to necessitate that I had to give beyond what I had. So I would suggest we need a different system. And some churches are beginning to do this, beginning to look at ministry in the context of a person's life and what they have, not just give them a job spec for Superman and say, get on with it, although many are not. So self-care is often also labelled bad or selfish. You know, you're not really a proper Christian if you're doing self-care, because we're told to lay down our lives for others. And so the calling of the martyr, you know, it's like, well, come on, think about the martyrs. They didn't practice self-care. Now, I am grateful for the martyrs who gave their lives so that the Christian message could spread in the Greco-Roman world thousands of years ago. I want to honour what they've done. But I would suggest to you, not all of us are called to be martyrs. We may be called one day to be a martyr. We may be called to be willing to be a martyr. Although I'm not going to start bragging about that. If it comes to it, I don't know what I'd choose. I'd like to think I would choose the right way, that I'd be willing to lay down my life. I don't know. I don't really want to even presume I'm in league with the martyrs. But we're not all called to be martyrs. We may be called to be willing, but we don't have to actively pursue killing ourselves in the context of ministry or in the context of life. We can choose to care for ourselves. Relationships are the framework for healing. And this is especially true considering that we are relational beings and our sense of self is relational. Remember, as a relational being, we need to cultivate and steward our relationship to self. And the strength of our relationship to God and others is entwined with our relationship to self. You can't separate them. To love God and love others and love creation effectively, you have to love yourself in a healthy sense of that word. To care for others effectively, you have to care for yourself. It's just that simple. If you're not in a good place, how can you care for someone else? And so the double love command, the famous double love command in Matthew 22, verses 34 to 40, Jesus is asked, what is the greatest commandment? And Jesus says, well, the first is love God, and the second like it is love your neighbor and love yourself. We say love neighbor as self, but it's the same implication. The double love command is a triple love command. Love God, love neighbor, love yourself. Now, as for my creation thing I added in, I think if you're going to do that well, you have to care for creation. There are plenty of people in the world suffering because we're not doing that very well. So the double love command is a triple love command. Jesus says, you know, caring for yourself is not just a good idea, it's a command from Jesus. Love God, love your neighbor, love yourself. So a few insights from one of our ambassadors. Sanctuary has two ambassadors, Dr. Hilary McBride, who is a well-known podcaster and award-winning therapist and author, and Professor John Swinton, who is a world-renowned practical theologian at the University of Aberdeen. He is our other ambassador. John's work has influenced Sanctuary heavily, so if ever you read a John Swinton book, you might come across some of these ideas. They're not mine, they're John's. Maybe he stole them from someone else, I don't know. But Hilary offers some insights on self-care, given that this is something she talks about quite often and has done workshops for us before. Hilary says, we think self-criticism is necessary for motivation. You know, we will never accomplish anything if we aren't hard on ourselves. Hilary once said to me, Dan, do you ever talk to yourself? And I'm like, no. And she's like, well, think about it. Do you ever verbalize anything to yourself? And I'm like, oh, actually, I do. Yeah. When I want to give myself a kick up the pants, I will say, like, come on, Dan, come on. So it's only ever in a negative context that I talk to myself. I think she kind of could see that that might be the case, which is why she asked me. So often we think self-criticism is necessary for motivation. We often respond to our negative emotions in ways that create more hurt, causes us to go within ourselves, to criticize ourselves, to repress our emotions. And thirdly, Hilary says that self-hatred is costly at a physical level. Think about that holistic vision of a person, biological, psychological, social, spiritual. Hilary says when we verbalize criticism to ourselves, brain scans show that the same part of the brain light up when we are hurt physically and verbally. So the idea of sticks and stones may break my bones, but names will never hurt me is not true. Brain scans show that. But the same part of the brain lights up when we criticize ourselves. So we're actually doing ourselves damage. This is true when we are the ones doing the hurting. And just a great question. If you are filled with shame and self-hatred, where do you go to feel safe? The safest place for us as people should be safe places, because we're stuck with us. And if it's not a safe place, where do we go? Well, we go to other places to feel safe. We go to other places to soothe our pain. And the whole, all of the research on addictions, you know, I think many of us implicitly grew up with a belief growing up that addictions, well, that's what sinful people do. Well, every person is sinful, so I guess that's true. But addictions are really what people do to try and soothe their pain, to find something that is constant that will make them fill a need in that moment. And I would probably track with local renowned therapist and author Gabor Mate, who says that all of us are traumatized and all of us are addicted to something. Most people these days, you can guarantee they're addicted to their phones. Just look at your phone use and tell me you're not addicted. The little endorphins that fire when someone gives you a thumbs up on social media, that's how they design them, just so you know. That's not a criticism. I have a smartphone, and I'm probably addicted to it. So there we go. But, you know, we have socially acceptable addictions like success and money and wealth and status, and then there are those that we just say, oh, well, these people, you know, drug addicts. You know, these are bad people. Hopefully you realise I don't think that's true. So how do we theologize self-care when Scripture explicitly tells us to lay down our lives for one another? If you find yourself asking this question, you are not alone. I think many Christians find it difficult to distinguish between self-care and selfishness. However, there is one very significant difference. Self-care enables us to serve others, while selfishness prevents us from serving others. The goals of self-care extend beyond our personal health, because when we are flourishing, we can contribute to the flourishing of our families, our friends, and our communities. Investing in yourself is an investment in your families, friends, and communities. One of the ways the New Testament addresses this reality is through communicating the truth that we can only give what we have received. We love because he first loved us. 1 John 4:19. Out of the overflow of God's love for us, are we able to love others? This principle, I think, is true for self-care. And this doesn't mean we have nothing to offer if we are languishing or experiencing mental health problems. In fact, we may have much to offer. Instead, it is simply a reminder of the perspective that should shape our self-care. We must receive care and companionship ourselves if we want to offer care and companionship to others. So how do we live lives where care and companionship for ourselves is cultivated? Here are a few ideas as I come into land. Some self-care practices. Boundaries. There's a great book called The Boundaries Book. Who wrote The Boundaries Book? Cloud and... Yeah. Townsend, is it? Yeah. Anyway, it's a great book. Look up The Boundaries Book. I always forget who wrote it. I think it was Cloud and Townsend or... Yeah, read it. It's a great book. Some people do boundaries. They just know how to be boundaried. And they go, why do you write a book about this? It's just obvious. There's a lot of people who don't know how to be boundaried. They read this book and they go, oh, I didn't know I could be boundaried. I didn't know I could say no to things. I thought I just had to please people all the time. Well, good news. This is a great book. It can help you. Secondly, ask for help. If you're in leadership, definitely ask for help. It allows you to be a human being. And churches need human beings leading them, not gods, if you know what I mean. You are not God. You are a human being that serves God. So be a human being, ask for help. And ask for help from God, but ask for help from others. Emotional regulation. Pay attention to your emotions and allow yourself to feel them. Don't deny your emotions. If you feel angry, feel angry. It's telling you something. If you feel sad, feel sad. Press into those emotions. Don't deny them. Self-compassion. This includes kindness. Say to yourself what you would say to others. It includes mindfulness. Acknowledge the reality and acknowledge your emotions instead of criticizing or shaming yourself. Be kind to yourselves. Something you could do for Lent. I know Lent has started, but you could say like 3 kind sentences to yourself a day. Just try it. See if it works. Avoid emotional reasoning. Instead, stay with the emotions and feel them. Practice your awareness of our common humanity. You know, pain unites us. It's something we all go through. It's something we all feel. And yet, many, particularly mental health, in mental health or mental health problems can cause us to feel isolated, can cause us to feel like no one understands what I'm going through. I assure you, if you find the bravery to speak about this in a faith context, you'll find a ton of other people that are in the midst of something as well. So be brave enough to do that. And don't ever feel like your pain isn't valid because in your perception, it's less than someone else's. Don't say, oh, they've got it worse than me because they've got this terminal illness and I just feel sad. Don't do that. Your pain is valid. Don't compare your pain to someone else's. So develop a growth mindset, defining success according to effort, not outcome, and refusing to take on failure as an identity. This is an idea that's emerged in educational theory in the last sort of 15 years, particularly, that we need to train our children to be lifelong learners. We need to help them to see that success is not about being the best at everything. It's about being the best at what they have and who they are, about actualizing and learning and growing. And we don't want our children to grow up learning how to win quizzes, like general knowledge. I want my children to grow up making wise choices, to know how to discern. And so a growth mindset is someone who I think will make wise choices, whereas just knowing how to pass quizzes or get A grades, great, enjoy your letters after your name, but can you make wise decisions? The world needs people who can make wise decisions. Just trust me on that one. So, and finally, Hillary says, this is one of Hillary's, receiving physical touch from loved ones, or even yourself. Try cradling your face or placing your hand over your heart. You know, it's really funny, but when Hillary tells me about these things, I think, you know, quite often I do this, just at different times. I'll just sort of, maybe I hear some news or something, or I definitely know when things are tough, I go, you know, what is that about? Is it my desire to be cradled? Who knows? But, you know, hugging someone is good as long as they know that you're going to hug them. You have to tell them first. You can't just grab someone in the street and hug them. I'm definitely not telling you to do that. But physical touch is necessary. We were made for it. So, great. I'm just coming into land. Each of us is of immense value and worth, worth caring for. If that is true for the people that you serve, it has to be true for you as well. There's no hierarchy in God's kingdom. Everyone is equal. If you tell your congregants or the people in your teams or your family how valuable they are, how you love them, how they're worthy of love, the same has to be true for you. Don't be a hypocrite. It's true. It has to be true. To be the best leader, parent, helper, spouse, person you can be, you need to care for yourself. It is from that place of care that you are able to minister to and from the overflow of your lives. I'm just going to close. We've got 1 minute 40 seconds. I'm going to close with this great definition of love, which was given to me by my good friend John Swinton. Love equals saying and meaning, it's good that you exist, and I'm glad that you're here. Every human being on the planet needs to be told that probably at least once a week. For someone to mean it and say, it's good that you exist, I'm glad that you're here. A very simple definition of love, but something we can all begin to practice. And as I said, if other people are worthy of having that said to them, you are worthy of having that said to you. We can say that to ourselves. Finally, as I've got 1 minute left, this is Sanctuary, the organization that I lead. We have social media, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. We have a newsletter. We have a podcast. We have a blog. We have cool resources that you can use in your churches, small group resources. Other things are happening. And that's it. I have to stop talking. So I'm sorry we didn't have time for questions, but God bless you and thank you for spending the last 45 minutes with me. Thanks.